Welcome to Radiology with a Dose of Insight, where South Africa's imaging story comes alive. I'm your host, Dr. Manta Magume, and in each episode, we explore the people, the science, and the breakthroughs transforming radiology across our healthcare landscape. From hospital corridors to innovation hubs, we unpack how imaging is evolving, what it means for patient care, and where the next frontier lies. So whether you're behind the scanner, in the wards, or simply curious about the power of imaging, tune in, be inspired, and stay ahead. Brought to you by GE Healthcare Pharmaceutical Diagnostics, advancing radiology together. Imagine a world where doctors treated the invisible, where disease hid in shadows, the human body was a mystery. Then in 1895, a flicker of light in a dim German lab changed everything. Wilhelm Röntgen had stumbled upon a new kind of ray, and with it opened medicine's first true window into the human body. From that spark came a century of fearless pioneers, those who dared to thread catheters into their own hearts, inject dyes into the unknown, and challenge what we thought was impossible. Their curiosity didn't just make radiology a science, it made it a revolution. Today, we pay homage to that legacy. From x-rays to angiograms, from black and white plates to AI-powered imaging, we trace how radiology transformed not just how we see patients, but how we save them. This is Radiology with a Dose of Insight, where we explore the history, the heroes, and the moments that shaped modern medicine. Stay with us as we uncover the extraordinary story of how radiology taught the world to see the unseen. Today's guest is someone whose name has become synonymous with radiology excellence in South Africa, Dr. Ashesh Ranchat. Dr. Ranchat is a diagnostic and interventional radiologist with more than 20 years of experience in the field. He is a founding partner and senior radiologist at the NRS Incorporated. He also serves as an honorary lecturer in radiology at Wits University in Gauteng, as well as an examiner for the College of Radiology. Over the years, he's shared his expertise through countless lectures, both nationally and internationally, covering everything from neuroradiology and pediatric imaging to advances in breast and body imaging. His passion for teaching and mentorship has helped shape many young radiologists coming up in the profession. Dr. Ranchat is also deeply involved in the professional radiology community, holding memberships with leading global and local organizations. Beyond the classroom, he's known for his curiosity, his warmth and commitment to driving innovation in South African radiology. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ranchat, a lifelong learner who continues to illuminate the fascinating world of medical imaging.
Thank you, Manta. It's an absolute honor and pleasure. I'm so glad to be part of this initiative.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ranchat, for joining us again. I'd like to start with right at the inception of X-rays, right? Röntgen says a new kind of rays. So if we start basically at the nomenclature, what could that have been about?
If we go back to William Conrad Röntgen, when he discovered these rays, he didn't know at the time what rays they were. And remember, he was in his laboratory experimenting with cathode rays. And this new type of ray, which was invisible, was unknown. And that's why he called it X-rays at the time, because in mathematics, we always solve for X. X marks the spot, or X is the unknown variable. And he thought in his mind, let me call it X-rays for now, and eventually thinking that when he resolved that issue, he'll probably change the name. But little to his knowledge at the time, X-rays persisted.
Great. What are some of the earliest stories? I know there's a story about a ring and a hand. Can you take me a little bit about that anecdotal
Sure.
story?
So if we go back to that origin and this discovery of X-rays in his laboratory, this was accidentally discovered on the 8th of November, 1895. So you can imagine that Wilhelm Röntgen was a mechanical engineer and a physicist. He was busy experimenting with these various types of Crookes tubes. in his laboratory. So these were tubes with vacuums and low gases, gases with low pressure actually. And he was trying to learn about cathode rays, and electricity was a new invention at the time, and electromagnetism was a new invention. And two scenarios in terms of the imaging that you've asked. While experimenting and while he discovered these invisible rays that he called X-rays, he happened to expose himself in front of a piece of lead, and he saw a shadow of his skeleton on one of the screens. And that was usually in the 2 week period after he made this discovery. And then to prove and to prove to the international community, he utilized his wife, Anna Bertha Ludwig. And 2 weeks after his discovery, he exposed her left hand, and she had to stay in position for approximately 15 minutes to be able to get this exposure of her left hand. So we have the very first X-ray of Anna Bertha Ludwig showing her left hand with a ring.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at this X-ray, it's kind of darkish, a bit hazy, unsharp. You cannot see the interphalangeal joints that well, but you can make out that it's a female hand, and you can make out it's a bulky ring on that ring finger. Subsequently, for a more palatable presentation, Willem exposed his friend, Albert van Kolliker, and he then used his X-ray at a presentation a few weeks later after the initial X-ray of his wife. And so we have a second hand X-ray, which you can then assess that it looks of a male hand. The ring is less chunky, less bulky, and looks like a male ring, and the fingers are much more slender and taller. And so one should remember there are two X-rays that are out there in the ether. The very first X-ray, which one can diagnose, is that of his wife's hand. And the very second X-ray is likely that of his friend, Albert van Kolliker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think not many people realize, having looked at these two X-rays, there is a difference between the two X-rays. And if you're astute, you will figure the chunky female ring versus the slender male ring and the slender male fingers.
So I think it's something that the radiologist would be more likely to detect other than the rest of us.
I think that should be up the alley. If the radiologist is a radiologist, it's up his alley to pick that up.
Okay. Of course, with any new technology, applications can veer on the ethical and not so ethical side of things. What are the earliest and most creative, perhaps, ways that X-rays were then used?
So after the invention of X-rays, which was a fascination and awe to the general population at large and as well as the medical community, if we look at some of the unethical uses of X-rays, so at that time they didn't realize the damage that X-rays can cause, especially the cumulative dose. So we find that X-rays were incorporated into shoe stores. And, you had these small fluoroscopic units in the shoe stores, and children are often encouraged to go into the booth and try on their new shoes and wiggle their toes that they could see live on fluoroscopy, wiggle their toes to prove to the mums that the shoes were the correct shoes and it was correct fitting for the child. And so, they repeated this willy-nilly and without any idea of the cumulative dose to the child as well as to the person operating the unit. So remember, in these shoe stores, most of the attendants were female, and so females were exposed to this radiation without any lead protection. So mm-hmm. this was the use of fluoroscopy in shoe stores. Fluoroscopy is also used in hair salons and beauty parlors. They try to treat acne and wrinkles by radiating patients' faces. They also used it and advertised it as a hair loss technique. And of course, it was a hair loss technique. They over-radiated.
It caused your hair to be lost.
Yes,
right?
they over-radiated these innocent public, and they caused disfigurement. They caused radiation burns. And what did they actually do? They burnt the hair follicles, and obviously the hair fell off. So yes, it was a hair loss technique, but it was a permanent hair loss technique.
Okay. So moving on to a technical hurdle. Now that we have X-rays and it's been used in largely a wide variety of ways, X-rays still only showed bones. And we're now moving to a period where we're now starting to explore whether we can visualize blood vessels. Can you tell us a little bit more about Mona's and what happened next with the angiograms?
Okay, so let's consider the scenario in the early 1920s. X-rays have been invented and they've been used for now many years, 20-odd years that X-rays have been used. And what were the maladies of the time? Everything that any illness that a patient had was always thought it was due to some sort of brain disorder. And the brain being a mysterious organ, until today, we don't know everything about the brain. Mm-hmm. So that being a mysterious organ, lots of doctors wanted to investigate and utilize X-rays to try and see and diagnose brain disorders. Now, at that stage, what were the imaging modalities available? So X-rays were invented and we had a thing called pneumoencephalograms. Mm-hmm. So pneumoencephalograms basically was the injection of air into intrathecally, and you could get air into the cranium and then take X-rays. And you looked at air that was moved due to tumors or mass effect. You looked at the asymmetry of the air in the ventricles. And this was quite a dangerous procedure and also created a lot of headaches. So the armamentarium to the physician at the time was only X-rays and pneumoencephalograms. And there was always this thought that can we not image the brain any further? And since X-rays were available and we cannot see blood vessels and blood per se, this being radiolucent, the thought was always to try and introduce some sort of intra-arterial or intravenous medium mm-hmm. that could opacify blood and hence opacify blood vessels. And if we could take X-rays of that, that would help us hopefully diagnose pathology. So Mona's, being a neurologist in the early 1920s in Lisbon, University of Lisbon, he was quite curious and he performed the first catheter angiogram on a live patient. What do I mean by that? The patient was alive and he injected contrast in a live vessel. Mm-hmm. Now, let's step back. After X-rays were invented, there were lots of cadaveric angiograms that were performed. So people injected contrast and toxic chemicals into cadaveric vessels and opacified and took X-rays. But Mona's is the man that first did an angiogram on a live patient. And using this angiogram, that was the basis to catheter angiography, intracranial angiography. And they used this to identify arterial venous malformations, aneurysms, tumor supply, and also look at the mass effect due to lesions in the brain. Mm-hmm. And that was the root of cerebral angiography. One of the hurdles was what to use. What was that chemical to use? And there were lots of different mixtures that were made, and these were most often toxic and also radioactive. We had thorium dioxide, also known as thorotrast. Mm-hmm. That was used extensively for many years for catheter angiography, and this remained permanently in the bodies, caused radiation. Patients developed organ failure, developed cancers and leukemias. We had things like a mixture called Teichmann's mixture. Teichmann's mixture was also quite toxic. It had paraffin inside. It had cinnabar, which is actually mercury sulfide, and it had another chemical, calcium carbonate inside, and this was quite toxic. So you needed a contrast medium that was safe, that was did not dissociate in water, and also did not kill the patient. So Mona's was the first thing to be. That would be detrimental, yes.
That would be a priority to keep the patient alive.
That didn't happen always because of all the toxic chemicals that they used, but he was the first to inject sodium iodide. Mm-hmm. And that's also, again, the route to the use of sodium iodide as
a contrast
medium. So
that then became the base for what we're currently using in part of our contrast media that's available.
That is correct. There is about 3 or 4 origin stories to the progressive use of safer and safer sodium iodide. But that is one of the stories. He was the first to use sodium iodide in a living patient.
I definitely look forward to the next episode where we fully go into the evolution of iodine as part of the contrast medium as well. Moving on to a different body part. There is Werner Forssmann, quite a sassy bugger, who managed to catheterize himself. Can you take us through that story?
Sure. Werner Vossmann was a physician, and he was studying surgery at Eberwald Clinic. And this was in Germany, and he was thinking, he had the spark. Patients were dying of cardiac failure, patients were dying of different diseases, and he thought that it would be nice to catheterize the heart and be able to drop intravenous medication right to the heart, and he felt it would be more effective and maybe it will work better and it will save lives. So at the time in his surgical department, he probably toyed with the idea and mentioned it to his professor, who shot it down immediately because the heart was regarded as sacrosanct in those days. If you touch the heart, patients died. They felt that maybe the patient was going to develop an infarct or the patient was going to develop a cardiac arrest. And so it was a no-go zone, and he was flatly shot down. Anyway, he was still intrigued about this idea. And if you go back, where was this inspiration? Well, he remembers looking at a picture in one of his textbooks of a horse that was cannulated. So the horse was cannulated directly in the internal jugular vein as well as the carotid artery. And two catheters were passed via those vessels into the right atrium and the left atrium, respectively. And he thought if this could be done in the horse, then surely it could be done in the human. But he was not going to get past his professor. So he decided that he was going to have to test it on himself. Now, this young 25-year-old gentleman then worked out a method to be able to do this. And remember, there was no catheters available. Angiography did not exist. And so he postulated that he's going to cannulate himself with a urethral catheter and somehow get it to the heart and see in terms of that. So he convinced one of his theater scrub sisters, a lady by the name of Ditson, and she was actually a nurse in charge of sterilization and sterile products for surgery. And he convinced her to be his assistant in crime. And she was happy to do this, but she had one provision. She wanted to be the very first person to be cannulated. And somehow he agreed with her. He took her to a theater and he restrained her. He gave her some local anesthetic, and she, not realizing and seeing what was being done, she thought that she was being cannulated. But while she was restrained, he then localized his forearm and did a cut down and cannulated an antecubital vein in his antecubital fossa with a urethral catheter, about 60 to 65 centimeters. So first he just threaded it in, and then he released the restraints from Ditson, who was on the table. And she was quite happy, and she comes off and she looks at her arms and she realizes, guess what? There's nothing on her arms. And she looks at his arms and realizes, guess what? The catheter is dangling from his antecubital fossa. So she was quite shocked at that outcome. But nevertheless, he convinced her to direct him to the X-ray department, which was in the basement. And so together they walked down to the basement, and in the fluoroscopy room, under fluoroscopic guidance, he then threaded the catheter further and then threaded it all the way up to his right atrium. And this they could see on fluoroscopy, and then they exposed and did a chest X-ray. So we have that very first cardiac catheterization by Werner Vossmann, showing the catheter tip in the right atrium. Mm-hmm. And obviously this caused an uproar. That X-ray was shown to his head of department, who was not pleased at all, but realized the importance of this discovery and allowed him to further experiment on really sick patients. And he saved one patient who was really ill by catheterizing her and allowing intravenous infusion of medication. And that was the route to cardiac catheterization.
But he was not particularly popular with that. And it only took André Cunand and Ditson to legitimize this procedure and eventually go on to win the Nobel Prize in 1956. Can we jump onto the second serendipitous moment with Mason Stones, with the accidental injection of dye, and how did that come about, and how subsequently did that contribute to radiology as we know today?
So Sones was a pediatric cardiologist and he was performing a routine, what we call indirect coronary angiography and aortography. So he was going to use a catheter and opacify the thoracic aorta, and indirectly, rather than cannulating coronary arteries, he was going to opacify the coronary vessels and also look at the valves in this particular cardiac patient. So while performing the procedure, he accidentally cannulated one of the coronary ostia. And also, before he could retrieve the catheter, he accidentally ended up injecting a huge bolus, a large volume of contrast, into the coronary vessel. Now, if we step back and we said that the heart was sacrosanct in the 1920s, when Werner Fosman actually cannulated the heart, now we're at a stage about 20, 30 years later where angiography was routine and has been done already for 10, 20 years, but coronary angiography, direct coronary angiography, was not routine. And that, again, was now the second sacrosanct spot, that it was said that if one cannulated the coronary vessel, we ran the risk of the patient developing cardiac arrest and therefore dying. And so no one ever dared cannulate coronary arteries. So what happened in this child was that when he injected the contrast, so firstly, in error, he cannulated. Secondly, in error, they injected a huge bolus. And the patient didn't die. The patient just went into a systole. And now, thinking on his feet, he quickly told the patient to start violently coughing. And the violent cough then reinstored the cardiac rhythm. And so everyone was shocked in the theater, because once he cannulated that, they all expected the patient to die, but the patient didn't. And that was the thought process that then started to say, if I manage to inject such a large volume of contrast into a coronary vessel and the patient survive, surely the patient will survive if I use dilute contrast with a smaller volume and actually do direct coronary angiography, which was never ever done prior. And so we experimented further, and he laid the foundations for what we call catheter or direct coronary angiography. And that's why Sunez is called the godfather of coronary angiography today.
Oh, great. So looking back at Röntgen's selflessness and Fosman's bravery, Sonne's serendipitous accident with the bolus injection, what's the most important lesson about scientific progress that this history of radiology has taught us to date?
So if we look at scientific progress, progress only happened because of people that were brave, that were audacious, and that were ethical. Science progresses due to the absolute ethics of a chappie like William Röntgen, who, due to his selflessness, didn't patent the invention, the accidental invention of X-rays. He allowed humanity to use X-rays, and for the greater good of humanity, he didn't make money off his accidental invention. Remember, after his father passed on, he was left with a huge amount of money. But because of World War I and huge rise in inflation in Germany, he became penniless. So he was bankrupt. And yet he didn't patent his invention, which could have made him a lot of money. Science has progressed because of the absolute audaciousness and chutzpah of people like Werner Fosman. Fosman wanted to challenge the dogma at the time that the heart was sacrosanct. And he was willing to sacrifice his career, but not only his career, he was willing to sacrifice his life by cannulating this vein. Who knew if the vein ruptured and he died? He was willing to sacrifice his life. And this is what pushed the boundaries and gave rise to the notion of putting cardiac catheters and for intravenous drug administration, for measuring pressures in the heart. And also the ingenuity of people like Sunez. What was thought to be a potential disaster, he converted that into the origins of catheter angiography by thinking on his feet and salvaging the situation by getting the patient to violently cough and reinstore sinus rhythm. So science progresses because of people like these. And we must always remember that science, medicine, and physics does not progress because of what we know. It progresses because of what we dare.
Thank you for that. It really was an interesting chat. You touched on injections and dyes and the toxicity. And I would like for us to explore the chemicals or the origin story of iodine and how it got to where we are currently. And I also look forward to the development of dyes alongside the technology that we currently use, such as the CT and MRI. With that, I would like to say thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.